We are now recording audio, and that will go up along with the deck after tonight's Q&A session. Welcome all. If we have any guests with us, we're glad to entertain any guests. If you want to become a member, that's great. However, don't feel an obligation to do so. As I mentioned before, we do have a really full agenda, so I think I will... well, just in the last note of if you have anything to throw into the chat window, fine. I am going to mute all, and you will have the ability to unmute yourself.
Is that the recording?
Yeah, the recording is going. And I will now mute all. You will have the ability to unmute yourself. If you want to jump in with a question or comment, feel free to do so, or you can throw it into the chat. So I'll kick it over now to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck.
Okay, thanks, Chris. We do have a bunch of different things tonight, and I'm going to kick it over straight away to Linda, who's got a follow-up from last week.
Okay, thanks, Alan. So, yeah, we were talking last week about Google Photos and what it is and what's the current rules and what's going to change come June. So that's what I want to talk about tonight just for a few minutes. So next slide, please, Alan. So currently with Google Photos, you have unlimited free cloud storage of what they call high quality images, and that's anything up to 16 megapixels. And that's nothing to sneeze at. I mean, if your camera's 5 or 6 or 7 years old, it may not even be as big as 16 megapixels. It may only be 12 megapixels. So it's plenty big enough if you were showing anything, displaying it digitally. It's plenty big enough for 8 by 10s, 11 by 14s, maybe even poster size, I don't know. But so that's what they call high quality. And you also had unlimited free storage for videos up to 1080p. Now, any pictures that you put up that were bigger than 16 megapixels are currently automatically reduced unless you change the upload settings in Google to be original quality. But in that instance, if you do change that to original quality and upload some images that exceed the 16 megapixels, that will count against your 15 free gigabytes. But the other ones, 16 megapixels or less, don't. So what other features are currently in Google Photos? Well, they have these organized functions. You can sort things by when the picture was taken, where, who's in the photo. You can search on general descriptors like car or dog or tree. And then you can identify particular people or dogs or whatever by clicking on and saying, this is this. Now give me a folder of just Fido. And you can also identify landmarks and locations, providing you took the picture with a cell phone or a camera that has a GPS. You've got some editing capabilities right now, sort of basic stuff, crop, straighten, some lighting adjustments, nothing too comprehensive, certainly not what I would consider a full editing suite, but a few things. And you can create and share online albums, sending people links to them, etc. And you can create and print a book. I have no idea what the quality is like. I've not used that. Okay, next. So what's going to happen after come June of this year? So the good news is any high-quality images that have been uploaded prior to June of 2021 will not be reduced in resolution, and they will not count against your 15-gigabyte quota. So that's kind of nice. You can just leave them there. Any new images will count against the 15 gigabyte quota, regardless of whether it's that high quality or the original quality. They're both going to count as of June. But again, pictures taken and uploaded from a Google Pixel phone in high quality, so up to 16 megapixels, will not count towards the 15 gigabytes because it's a Google product. So, just remember that the 15 gigabytes is shared across all the Google products like Gmail, your calendar, contacts, Google Drive, etc. Okay, next. So other features after June, the search functions look to me to be about the same, but they have thrown in a heat map of the world that shows where you've been, again, providing the photos have been geotagged somehow. And there's going to be more editing options. dynamic contrast. There's going to be a color pop, a blur function, and portrait lighting. So if one side of a face is dark and the other side's light, you can lighten up that one side of the face. So a bit more, still not full editing capabilities, but better than it was. And Google will create little cinematic photos, like either that individual photo that kind of moves, or they'll take a collage of, they'll build a collage for you, but also they may take four or five pictures of Fido and make it into a little mini movie, which is kind of scary. But anyway, and then you can create online albums as before, but you have more sharing options, especially if a person has a Google account. And as before, you can create a printed album, a paper album. Next. So what's the bottom line as far as I'm concerned for Google Photos? Well, there's the prices. So 15 gigabytes for free and then 2 terabytes for $14 a month. And there's actually even more if you're willing to pay $100 a month or something. Those are in Canadian dollars. If you're using the 15 gigabytes to store photos, personally, I would use it for backup storage, just because some of my images might be more than that 60 megapixels, or they might be in the future. So I wouldn't use it as my primary storage. That would be my desktop, but I would certainly use it as backup storage. And if my desktop or whatever happened and I had to use these to resurrect all my photos, I wouldn't be heartbroken because 16 megapixels, as I say, is usually pretty big, usually big enough for most purposes. But from what I can tell, before June, you can load as many photos or videos as you want in the next few weeks, and it will not count against your 15 gigabyte quota, providing they're under that maximum size. So if anybody wants to hop on right now, they will be archived forever and never count against your quota. So that's kind of how I saw it, and thanks to Chris for helping me with some of the research.
And Tom's made a note here that you may have multiple Google accounts at the same time.
True.
Presumably you could get multiple 15 gigabytes if you tried hard.
Absolutely.
Okay, thanks very much, Linda. And on to the next. This is a share from Chris.
Yeah, tomorrow is World Password Day. So it's first Thursday of every May is World Password Day. That falls tomorrow. And some of the tips for good passwords, passphrases, not passwords, string together three or more words, at least 12 characters long. Make sure it's not a common phrase or a keyboard pattern like QWERTY or QAZ, WSX, things like that. Make sure you have unique passwords for every service or site that you use. Keep in mind that length wins over complexity every time. Use a password manager so that you don't have to remember all of those unique passwords. And think about digital inheritance. What will happen if you're incapacitated or die? Will somebody else be able to get into your online accounts and do what you would like done with them if you're incapacitated? So just some tips on that. And there's a bunch of sites around the internet that have information on World Password Day. An opportunity for everybody to take a look at your current passwords and see if they should be strengthened.
Okay, thanks. Thanks, Chris. Yes, everybody should strengthen their passwords tomorrow. Okay, we've got a few slides here on a friend's laptop. She has a little problem, as you might see here in the screen, when the computer boots. This is the screen that you get. And so there's clearly a problem with either the video card or the screen itself, or perhaps even the cable that connects the LCD screen to the motherboard. The problem is, of course, that when the screen looks like that, you can't actually do anything. You can't log in, really. You can't obtain any files off the system because you can't see File Explorer. So that was one of the problems. This is a fairly old laptop, so she was thinking of replacing it with a new machine, but really wanted the old files. So I thought, well, it has an HDMI port. So if I plug in an HDMI cable, then I can see if it will fire up my external monitor. And sure enough, You can see here that the machine is actually booted into Windows. It still doesn't show anything on the main laptop screen, but I can drive everything from my external monitor. And so by doing that, I was able to make a backup of the computer, disk image, take the user files, the data files, and basically copy them onto the new machine. So I'm not sure whether, clearly it's not the video card because it's driving the external monitor, but I still don't know whether it's the screen itself or the cable. And the YouTube University has a nice video on how to replace the screen and how to replace the cable. And it's fraught with difficulty. You have to snap that plastic bezel off around the screen, which is always a bit hair-raising when things start to go pop. However, I managed to do that, and I could see the cable seemed to be in good shape. The connections were okay at both ends. So I suspect it's the screen, and it's an old laptop, and I don't think it's worth worrying about replacing the screen. But one of the things you can do is, of course, the hard drive is still working, so you can take the hard drive out and make it into a portable USB. And we've talked about this, several people have talked about this at different times. You basically buy a hard drive enclosure, and this you can see is a plastic one from Canada Computers. The actual drive from the computer slots into this USB interface right here. And then this plastic case, the top of it or the bottom of it, whichever you look at it, basically slides along the channel here. So it's a tool-free option. It's very easy. You just plug it in, put one of these pads in to stop it rattling around, slide the case on, plug the cable in, and you essentially have a portable USB drive for $10. And the good news about this one is I'd actually replaced the hard drive in this laptop some time ago with a 250-gig solid-state drive. So the portable USB drive is actually a solid-state drive now. So that's kind of a nice feature. However, my friend also gave me her main backup drive. And her main backup drive, as I say, the problem gets worse. And so anybody can figure out what the problem is here, but if you look at the file listing, folder listings, and especially if you look at the dates of the backup folders, you can see they all date to 2015. And so that's a little bit of a problem. It's a good job I was able to get the current files off the main hard drive or exchange the hard drive as I did. Because this backup essentially is useless in terms of current data files. So that brings us along to a well-known computer person who says, you don't back up for backup's sake, you back up so you can recover. An untested backup is only half done. Test your backups. And some of you who are on the members forum may recognize that from a few days ago by our favorite computer guru, Chris. So Chris and I are big on disk image backups, and we did a couple of articles in the newsletter a while ago about disaster recovery and how you should actually check your backups. There's all kinds of different ways of doing it. And if you read these two articles, you'll find that we've done it for you to prove essentially that disk imaging systems work really well. So you could actually just restore and check a single file or folder from your backup against your copy on the hard drive. If you have a fairly small data partition, which is well backed up with multiple backup copies, you could actually blow away the whole data partition and restore it, and again, check that the files are exactly as they should be. And if you're really brave, then you can actually just format the whole drive and then do a complete disk recovery from one of the images. And if you read the articles, you'll find that all of those things work, and they work very well. However, I think Chris is going to go one step further and show you how it's done.
Yeah, no, thanks, Alan. I could pretend that it's all in the interest of time that I won't blow away my whole hard drive and restore it from backup. But truth be told, I am chicken. I don't want to tempt fate. However, what I can do is I can show you how to recover individual files or folders. So now you see a real mess there. Okay. So here I have Windows File Explorer, and you can see I'm on Data Drive D, and I've created a folder on there called Backup Demo. In that folder, I have a file, and I have a folder within that folder called Fonts. I have a bunch of zip files. So that's what I'm going to do is I'm going to recover these. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to delete them. So they're now gone. And I'll show you as well on my Z drive, I have a folder here called Recovery Demo. And currently it's completely empty. So now I'm going to go into my backup program, which I use EaseUS to do backup. And the top job is the job that I run every night. So it runs at 1:01 in the morning. And you can see that it last run today, and it ran in 5 minutes. It did an incremental backup of my system. Now, if I want to do a recovery, I can click on recovery, and then I get this dialog box come up. Now, there's the disk partition mode, and that's where if I want to recover an entire disk, I could select the disk, and it'll automatically select all of the partitions on that disk, or I could just select an individual partition if I wanted to. Now, what I want to do is go into file mode, so I click on that, and one of the things you'll notice in this program, and this really annoys me, is by default, it has check marks on every partition on that particular backup set that I did. And I think that's absolutely ridiculous when you're in file mode. Typically, when you're in file mode, you just want to do a couple of files or a folder or a couple of folders, something like that. You don't want to recover every file on your system. So when I do a file mode recovery, the first thing I do is I deselect absolutely every one of the partitions. So now I'm saying I'm going to recover nothing. Then I can go down into the D, and there's that backup folder with the files. So this is looking at the backups. So if I actually just come to the D drive, I could just select that backup demo folder and everything that's within that, and I can recover it back to its original location. So I'll click on proceed. And it's done. So now if I come back to my D backup demo, there I have the folder, again, has been recovered to its original location with all its files in it. And if I look at the backup demo folder itself, it has that wonderful picture in it. So that's one way that you can do a recovery. And you might have noticed as well in there that there was another option. If I just do a finish and I come back to recovery. And now if I do the file mode again, and I again deselect all of these, so I'm not going to recover everything, and then I go down into D, and I come in, and let's say that I want to recover this again. There's another option is recover to. Now, you might think you could actually just double-click in here and type something in. You can't. I don't know why. But I can browse to it. So now I could come to drive Z, and I created a folder there called Recovery Demo. And so now I'm going to recover it to there. So I click on OK, and I click on Proceed. There's going to be one thing that's going to be a little bit odd about the way that it recovers to here, which actually I think is pretty good. Because if I come over now to the drive Z and the Recovery Demo, I don't have that folder and the one file. I have D, and then I have the folder, and then the files have been recovered to that. What it does is it recovers the entire path to it. I think it's kind of useful that way, because if you just leave that lying around, I might look later on and say, oh, this file, I want to put it back in its original location. I don't know where it came from, but I do in this case, because what it did was it recovered to the recovery demo, D drive, backup demo, and all of the files within it. Kind of cool the way it does that. Now, there is one other way that you can actually recover files within EaseUS to do backup, and that is something that I think most of the backup programs allow you to do. If I go to my S drive, that's my main 5-terabyte backup drive, and I go to EaseUS and Karina, which is the name of this computer, this is the backup job, and if I look at this, here we have the full backup, 762 gigabytes, and then the incrementals that were run every day. I can just double-click on any one of these, and it opens up in a File Explorer-type window. So I can then go on to where is it the files that I want to recover? Well, that was on Drive D. It's a little bit slower here. And I go into Backup Demo, and then I could select these, and then I can right-click, and I could say Copy. I say we could copy, and then I could just paste it in somewhere else. Or I have the same sort of options I had within the program itself to recover to the original location, recover to a specified location, or recover the latest version. If I selected any one of the other incremental files, it would actually look to see which one has the latest version of these files. And then I could recover those files to whatever location I wanted and so forth. There is a recovery option down here as well, which if I select those, I could then actually come here and say recover to the original location or recover to a different location. So that's it. Pretty simple and easy to be able to recover files. So I will stop the share on that. And if there are no questions, I'll let Alan carry on. If any questions come up as we go through the night, by all means, throw them into the chat window, and we'll cover them off a little bit later on. But hopefully you see that recovering individual files or folders, very, very easy with any of the backup programs.
Yeah, the only comments, Chris, were basically from Lawrence, who was saying that organizations probably wouldn't let you do a full backup recovery, and they probably won't either, because they're all chicken.
yeah. I have actually had occasion in disaster recovery to actually do a full recovery, and it worked, but I'm not about to do it just for fun.
Yeah, I think that's Lawrence's point, is they don't do anything that they don't have to do.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks, Chris. Okay, so now I'm moving on to some more of Tom's favorite apps. He sent me a whole list of things which he likes, and we're all desperate to know about his sunrise sunset alarm, which always goes off when he starts to talk to us. So Tom, if your mic's unmuted, I'll switch to your first slide.
Sunrise sunset. Why would you want an alarm at sunrise and sunset? Well, in my case, I'm looking out my window and I see the sunset, which is very cloudy today. But I also see this view in the early morning or it says sunset. So you can use it just to watch or to set your blinds, because when the sun is shining in and it's bright, then I usually have my blinds shut if it's very sunny. The sunrise and sunset times vary through the year. You can usually find them out in any GPS app, but you can also use a sun alarm. And here are a couple of screenshots from it. You can set it at the time of the sunrise sunset or before or after and which days. And it will run the alarm on before or after. So if you want to get up for the sunrise, you don't have to reset your clock every day. It varies when it's in the middle around the equinox. The times vary by about 4 minutes a day, so it takes a while. if you want to set your clock. But if you do want to get up at the sunrise or look out your window at the sunset, this is a useful app. And if you're concerned with time, there's this, in fact, there are several different apps like this, but Clock Tuner will check your watch. See if you're a watchmaker or a watch repairer, you can actually get devices that do this automatically and do a good job of it. But you can also use your smartphone and its microphone to detect what's happening. So it works on mechanical watches or clocks, and you can set what the beats per hour is. In this case, in my, I just took an example here, so it's not my watch, but this is similar to my watch. You can set inside my watch, you can set the watch to run a little faster or a little slower. So you use your microphone to detect the how fast it's going. You really need a quiet room for this, and you should probably be going for about 5 minutes or so to actually get a reasonable, reliable reading. But then it will tell you how fast or how slow your watch is without you having to kind of look at it every day, make a record, and so on. So if you want to tune your clock or your watch, your mechanical clock or watch, this will do it. And we're battery full. I have a smartwatch. It's a, what is it? It's a Fossil. But I have another smartwatch. It's in a case right now that is from, I forget now. At any rate, one of the things you want to do with a watch is make sure it's charged so you can actually see, because in fact I have a watch on each hand. And I use a smartwatch for taking a look at my app, my notifications and stuff like that. And I use the EverWatch for taking a look at the time without needing to kind of shake my hand. But if you want any kind of device to last, you really don't want to charge it to full every time. And so this particular app will actually give you an alarm when it reaches a particular percentage full, and it will tell you when that's happening so you can take your watch off the charger. It will also notify you when you leave your watch or phone behind, but I think most phones do that anyway with Google Wear. And using a maximum 60 or 80%, it maximizes the lifetime of the watch if you want your watch to last for years. This also applies to headphones, but I don't have anything similar for headphones. But 60% is best. 80% is more reasonable if you want it to keep going for a while. Daydream Screensaver. This is something you can set up on your smartphone. It's called Lucid Daydream Screensaver. You can look at it in the Android. This is all Android apps, by the way, if you hadn't guessed already. And you can set it to do this, and what it does is it, while your phone is charging, it shows the time and date, and it moves it around so that it's safe for an AMOLED screen like my particular Pixel. And in this, when you put it on, it shows the how charged it is right away, and then when it goes into the screensaver mode, it shows it for about a, I don't know, maybe a half an hour or an hour. And if you pay, it'll show it forever, but it shows the percentage as well as the time and the date. So that's, some people may find that useful. There are other things you can pay for. You can pay for a full version that does more stuff. But I just use the free version, and I find it useful to keep tabs on my phone and see how much it's charged. I also have an alarm on my phone, so when it charges to 62%, that goes beep. But that's another app. High intensity interval training. It gets you fitter faster. Google it. It's usually you have 10 to 30 seconds of really extreme effort, and then you rest 20 to 60 seconds. And you can actually get fit and stay fit with a 10-minute workout, but you should really check with your doctor before you start doing this. You can create programs for your exercises and your rest, and for that matter, you can use this program for meditation as well. Basically, it gives you timings, and it tells you when things are about to start or end with ticks, and then the tone to do things, and a big timer display that you can set to stay on so that you know how much you've done so far. I think it's a count-up timer rather than a countdown timer. Next. So here are examples. You can set up usually a workout, warm-up interval, cool-down. So those are the various things you can do. And then the Tabata is where it shows the timer. And I guess it's the time left. So this is actually set up for a 20-second effort. But my use of high intensity interval training is actually limited to, I live on the sixth floor of an apartment building. And basically I run up the steps two at a time, and that's my high intensity interval training. And I don't bother timing it. And then when I get to the top, I stretch out my hamstrings so that they don't hurt in the future, and I'm done for the day. All done.
Okay, thanks very much, Tom.
Are there any questions on any of this?
There's nothing showing up in the chat. Stuart says he has a cat which wakes him up at dawn, so he doesn't need any of this nonsense.
I haven't seen an app that will do that.
Oh, and Natalie says links. I guess we'll add those in later on since they aren't in these slides. Okay, thanks very much, Tom. Now, if Bob's still awake out there, I missed him off the agenda, but I tried to tell him he's next. You want to talk to the slides, Bob?
Oh, sure. Okay. We had a recent discussion, Chris and I were talking about the wireless keyboards and mice. And it was mentioned they weren't 100% reliable. And I observed the thing, and I have a wireless thing. But new computer in October, lots of RAM, and no problems at all. It's going good. The odd little issue. And I had no problems at all. And I thought for a few days, and occasionally I had a little copy and paste didn't work the first time, and then I had a few little issues. The more I thought about it, you know, I think I was having problems. So Chris was right, and Alan was right. So then I switched. I had a wireless keyboard and mouse, a wired. I had both around the house, and had a newer in the box, a wired keyboard, and put that in. It was amazingly better. It was I couldn't believe the difference. And the things that I thought were just me, really it wasn't me. I know I had a wired keyboard at work. Well, I made one little change in there. I don't know what I did, really. I unchecked the enhance pointer position. I'm sure people have more wisdom on this than I do. Apparently it visually leaves your mouse where it's going, but I'm not an expert on that. I unchecked that. That's all I did on that. And the improvements were phenomenal. And then, of course, the wired mouse in my golf game, my golf shots got a lot better now, too. It wasn't just me. I guess the wireless mouse, you click your thing at the right time, and I'm playing better golf now. So thanks to Alan and Chris, I'm now a better golfer.
Thanks for the miracle of wires, Bob.
Thank you, guys. Thank you. If anybody wants to play me on WGT Golf, I'm Bob from Canada 1.
Okay, thanks very much, Bob. I see Tom is putting the links to his various apps in the chat window, so if you're interested in those, you'll find the links there later on.
anyway, I'm impressed. Thank you.
Okay. I have a little share of my own, Warpinator. Now, it's a very interesting little program, except it's only really useful for people who run Linux and or Android. Warpinator is a file transfer program that was installed in Linux Mint in the latest version, which is release version 20. And just recently, in the last few days, in fact, they've released an Android version of the same app. So now I have the possibility of transferring files from my Linux laptop to my Android smartphone, basically using this Warpinator program. Whereas previously I'd been using a program called Software Data Cable, which essentially sets up a file transfer service on the phone and gives me an IP address, and then I link to that using an FTP client. I actually use FileZilla and then transfer the files to FTP. Now, but Warpinator works slightly differently, as we'll see. So here are the two apps. On the left, here's Warpinator running on my Linux Mint laptop. On the right, here's the new Android version running on my smartphone. So as a demo, I created this little text file, which says it's for today's Q&A session. So you know it's brand new and wonderful. And so what I do is I go to Warpinator on my laptop, and I browse by using this drop-down menu here. I browse my file system, and I find my file, and I say, okay, send that file. So on the laptop, it's now queued that file, and it says it's waiting for approval. And automatically on the smartphone, the smartphone sees the other device on the network, and it knows that this file is available, so it's waiting for me to basically hit the green check mark and authorize the file transfer. So as soon as I do that, it makes the transfer, and then it says on the phone, it says it's finished, and on the laptop, it tells me that the transfer has been completed. So now if I go to the file system on the phone, here is my received files folder. Here you can see the transfer of the file. And then if I pull that up in Writer Plus, which is an Android editing app, you can see that it's the same file with the Q&A for May the 5th. So that's a really nice little file transfer utility. The two devices have to be running on the same network, which is reasonable because that's exactly what I want to do. I want to copy files from one of my Linux computers to my smartphone and vice versa. But now it's doing it automatically, essentially. I don't have to bother with the FileZilla FTP client. So if you have Linux and or Android, that's a file transfer program that's worth taking a look at. Okay, moving along. There's been a question on the members forum from Micheline. She's trying to get an editor running called Sun Editor. And this package needs NPM, which is the Node Package Manager, which Micheline has installed on Windows 10. And then she tried to install the editor package by running this command, npm install sun editor, but it gives a whole bunch of error messages. So the question is, how do you actually run sun editor? So does anybody out there know anything about npm, and especially running JavaScript packages on Windows 10? Don't all shout at once.
Nothing so far in the chat.
Okay. My understanding is it this is a JavaScript package, so it needs to be converted. It needs reading into a JavaScript package editor and then saving as a JavaScript app, which will then either run in probably Node.js or as a browser app. But how you actually do that, I really don't know. And by the sound of it, nobody else is helping. And Jocelyn is asking whether JavaScript, maybe JavaScript isn't enabled.
I think it goes beyond just whether JavaScript is enabled, though. It's still how to actually call that JavaScript, which presumably would launch the editor. But I have no clue how you would launch the JavaScript and actually get it to run.
Yeah. Well, if anybody has any bright ideas, put something in the chat, or there's lots of chat on the user forum. And so you can always answer Micheline's query there. Okay, next question that came in is about hyperlinks not working in Outlook. You want to talk about this, Chris?
Yeah, I did a quick search on this, and the problem was they were getting this message saying your organizational policies are preventing us from completing this action and contact your help desk. Well, the person said, I don't have a help desk. It's my own computer. I'm retired. I'm at home. How am I supposed to get this to actually operate? So I did a little bit of searching on it, and I found that there were quite a few people who had this particular error message come up. And a lot of the fixes that were talked about were not exactly straightforward. There was one, if Internet Explorer is the default browser, there's a link there that might actually help. And if I can just break for just a second, if I can find my text pad, I'll find it in a bit. And I'll paste in all of the links into the chat window in a bit. So there was that, and then there was some discussion about it at answers.microsoft.com, which is their big answers forum, and there's a lot of help that's usually available in there, and there was some suggestions there that talked about it. If you happen to use Chrome or Firefox and uninstall that browser while the browser is set as the default browser, that some people said could cause the problem, and there was some instructions at slipstick.com, who's a big guru on Outlook-related issues and Exchange-related issues. So there was some talk on there about how you can actually fix it. And I think there was one more. There was another page at Stack Overflow that had some potential fixes to it. One of the other things I read at multiple sites was that this is not specifically an Outlook issue. It's a default browser issue. And so one of the suggestions, which could be tried very easily, is just change your default browser to something else and then change it back and see if that fixes your problem. If that doesn't, then you're into more involved things to try to get it working. Some of those links had some relatively simple things. Some of them had you going down and editing the registry. So the first thing I would try is certainly just changing your default browser, web browser in app settings, apps, and default apps, and change your default browser to something else, and then change it back and see if that fixes it. That's all I could find. If anybody else has any other ideas, you could unmute yourself and chime in or throw it into the chat window.
Again, there's nothing in the chat window so far.
Yeah. It really seemed to be an odd sort of problem that quite a few people had run across and multiple routes to a solution.
Okay, well, again, if anybody has any bright ideas, put it in chat or send us an email for a follow-up. So that's it for the prepared material. And as Chris said, we have some time. So if there are other issues that people want to ask about or things they want to share, Now is the time.
Tom has a comment in the chat that if you're doing editing to the registry, it's best to save the registry via system restore before you do any edits to the registry. And certainly if you are new to registry editing, be really careful, because certainly going hog wild on the registry and changing things willy-nilly can end up with an unbootable system. If you're following specific instructions, as long as they're trusted instructions, you should be okay. But, yeah, always backing up the registry through System Restore is a good idea. I wholeheartedly support that. Any other questions, niggling problems people are having? I can't believe that we're going to have, with a huge agenda, that we could actually end up early for the first time ever. Elizabeth just said yes. Is that you have a question, Elizabeth, or?
We're agreeing that it's best to save.
Oh, I see. Yeah, okay. Yeah. And having a complete image backup of your system is a good idea as well.
I was going to say I have so many niggling problems, I'm having trouble remembering which one.
I have one problem maybe people have seen. I have a My Harmony remote Kamsa, and or it's actually a Harmony 1 from about, I don't know, 6, 7, 8 years ago. And I'm running it with My Harmony on my computer, because you can load in a whole bunch of things for different televisions, VCRs, and stuff like that, all the different codes. But I find when I'm running My Harmony now, I get to where it wants to load activities, and it just hangs. Has anybody had this problem before? They have a Harmony remote and a solution?
Yeah, a little bit specific, but yeah, I know. I personally don't have a programmable remote at all. So
I just know that Logitech has discontinued manufacturing the Harmony product.
Yeah,
the support will disappear at some point, but they haven't. I don't know if they've set a date yet.
Did you check to see if there's an updated version of the software, Tom?
I did, and the last one I downloaded was just last year, and so I didn't bother to download another set. Maybe I shall. Maybe they've made a change since then, but I have my doubts about that.
I wonder if there's a possibility that it was a monthly update or biannual update to Windows that caused it to stop running. I wonder if you tried running a VM and see if it ran in the VM or something like that.
I never run a VM. That might be a nice thing to try. I have enough memory now to be able to do it. So,
yeah,
that'd be a nice educational opportunity.
Yeah,
would indeed.
Okay, there are a couple of questions in the in the chat. Eldon's asking about using Outlook as a mail client. But he doesn't always receive the emails in a timely fashion. Does anybody else have that problem, and do you know what the solution is?
If it's running, it depends on the mode that it's running in, I guess. If you're running in a POP or IMAP mode, there is a polling interval that your Outlook client will only go and look to the server at predefined times. So if you are in either of those modes, you could check and see if the in the settings for Outlook what the polling interval is. If it is connecting in, I forget what they call the mode, it's Outlook's and Exchange's native mode, There's no, like the server actually pushes things to the client. So there's no polling interval that you can actually choose. If that was the case, I'm not sure what would cause delays. I presume that you're talking about delays within the company, not from the outside world. If it's from the outside world, of course, all email is store and forward. And so who knows who's causing the delay. But within the organization, I wouldn't expect delays.
I'd suggest asking your corporate IT what the problem is, and then they can take a look.
Yeah, that's probably a good idea, Tom.
Second question there from Claudette. Has two Chrome setup apps with different sizes, which should I delete? I would have thought you could delete both of them, and next time you need it, you download the latest one. Does that sound reasonable?
That's what I would think would be the best approach. Anytime that you run something like that that is constantly evolving, I delete it as soon as it's set up, because you don't need it again. And by the time you need it again, there'll be a new version anyways.
Yeah, and Tom says that the setup just reads the browser from the web to install. So it really is just a transient program.
Yeah.
Another question here. Elizabeth can't get her sister to fix her PC, but at work, the IT people can remote into the machine. Is that available through some app? And you can certainly use TeamViewer for that. It's available for free on a personal use basis. But Chris, you use a Windows app for that too, right?
Yeah, if both computers are Windows 10, you could use Quick Assist. It's built into the operating system. So if you just click on Start and start typing in Quick, it'll pop up in the list, or it's under Windows Apps, I believe, if you go down the list. And it is really quick and easy to use. Is very nice. TeamViewer is really great if you've got either older versions of Windows or cross-platform. So there are TeamViewer apps for Mac and Linux and all the rest of it. So if you do happen to be in a position where you don't have Quick Assist on both computers, then TeamViewer is a very good option and very fast and easy to use. I've used both those approaches. Linda, is Linda still on the call? Linda has used both. And I just wonder, it looks like Linda's gone.
I'm here.
Oh, sorry. I didn't see you in the list. Okay. So what would you like to add? You've used both TeamViewer as well as Quick Assist.
Yes, I haven't used TeamViewer recently. I like the Quick Assist because it's so easy for people to set up. If I'm trying to help someone and I help people with their photo editing, it's easier to go to their machine and see their photos. And if they have Windows 10, that's great. I just say type in Quick. But if they don't, then they have to download a program, and some are reluctant, even though it's free, etc. So it's just one more step. So I prefer the Quick Assist just because it's nobody objects to it. It's already on their machine.
Yeah, good point.
There's a question here from Glenn. Can we suggest a Linux for Canon Zoom browser to run in Linux and download images from an old Canon camera over USB? I seem to remember that one of the digital image management programs did that automatically. If you plugged in a camera, it just saw it and suggested that you might want to download the files. I haven't done that for a long time, so I don't remember what program it was.
Yeah, most full-scale editors or digital asset managers will have that capability built in, so that's certainly an option to just try something like that. Unfortunately, there are some cameras that don't, when you plug them in, they don't set up as a drive letter. But even those will often just show up as a device. And so you can just browse into it as if it's a disk drive sort of idea. So I would also try that just to see if you can get it to show up as a device on the computer.
Yeah, this is, he's actually looking for a Linux app. He says Zoom browser must be a program.
Yeah.
Presumably from Canon.
Yeah.
Originally it ran in Windows, but now we need something that runs in Linux. I think I would just try Googling for image transfer capabilities or programs or something, Linux, and see what you get.
Yeah.
Yeah, Tom's suggesting that usually the camera would show up in Explorer in Windows by USB. He's asking, would you have to mount it in Linux? Normally, I don't think you do. I think when you plug it in, it sees the external drive and shows it to you. As I say, I haven't done it for a long time.
Yeah,
the other way to do it is to actually take the SD card out of the camera, if that's possible, and just plug it into a card reader.
Yeah, that might be the simplest approach for sure to be able to do that. I think the problem with Linux might be if it's – I've run into this with Canons before where they actually require the app. They don't map as a drive, but they do show up somehow as a device usually. And so I don't know how Linux will handle that, whether it will show up as a device that you can mount or but yeah, I think the Canon cameras they never showed up as a disk drive.
Well, if you're plugging it in USB, it should show up as a device.
Yeah. So I don't know, Glenn, do you have any comment on that? Did you try just plugging it in while in Linux, and did anything happen? You could unmute yourself, or okay, he will try. Okay, Glenn, maybe you can report back next week to say if you had any success in finding some way to do it, and that way, if there are other Linux users around here, they can benefit from your experimentation. Okay, thanks. Yeah. Any other last questions before we wrap it up? It looks like we are going to run full hour today, so that's good. Okay, yeah, Claudette has something.
Going in thick and fast all of a sudden.
Yeah.
So that says folder attributes when backing up read only. The only other option is hidden. It appears to be automatic. Why? What if I don't want either?
So they're being backed up as read-only. And Claudette, is that when you restore them, they come back as read-only?
No, when I'm backing them up.
How are you backing them up?
All my backup files seem to have been, you know, that's what they say when you try to restore as well, yes.
And what are you using to do the backup?
I was using Toolkit with Seagate Drive.
Okay, I'm not familiar with that at all. If anybody else has familiarity with that particular program.
Yeah, that would be one of these proprietary programs that comes with the drive when you buy it.
Yeah.
Exactly.
In a sense, I can sort of see a sense of backing up files and marking them as read-only so that if it's a backup, you don't want to accidentally modify the backup files. So I can sort of see a sense in that. But if you restore it, you wouldn't want them necessarily restored as read-only files. Seems kind of odd.
What you could do, Claudette, is use Free File Sync to back up from the hard drive to the Seagate USB drive, because then it just does a straight copy.
I see. Just to copy and paste.
Well, it does a file synchronization, so you can tell it I want to back up this folder or these files, and then it will keep them synchronized with the backup. but they're straight copies, so there's no read-only attribute added to the file.
Yes, so just copy and paste, you're saying.
Yeah, that would do too. Free file sync does it automatically for you. That's the beauty of it.
Yeah.
Okay. Today I'm doing copy and paste from my computer, and it is attached to the cloud, the OneDrive, and it's taken all day, and it's going to take all of tomorrow apparently as well. So it can take a long time.
Yeah, uploads can in particular be really slow.
You basically only get like your upload speed, a tenth of your download speed for uploads. So uploads can be really slow.
Yeah. So I'm hoping I'll be able to find a way to.
So Elizabeth's looking for a cell phone for her sister. An inexpensive cell phone under $100. Any takers? Anybody know of such a beast?
Almost all the carriers will give you good deals on things for, on a 2-year plan and things like that. Some of them will actually give you, a free phone on given monthly plans. So it's definitely worth investigating on that. Some of them are no great deals. The plan you have to go for might be more expensive than the plan you want. I find with Virgin Mobile, they actually have some pretty decent plans where, you compare the price of the same plan with not buying a phone and with buying a phone, and, the phone comes out to almost free anyways. And so there is that possibility for getting an inexpensive phone for sure.
And you check some of the big box stores, they have unlocked phones which are reasonably priced. I don't know if they're under 100, but certainly under 200.
Jocelyn commented that he just noticed the USB port on the router. Anyone use that and share your experience? I definitely have. It works actually pretty well. It is mappable from other computers that are on the network. So what you can do is set up every other computer in your house, map the drive letter to that one flash drive or whatever it is, an external hard drive that you plug into the router, and then you can access that storage from anywhere on the network. I had very good experience with it. Just nice. It's always there because the router's always on.
So that essentially gives you network-attached storage.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, what I find...
Stuart had done that too, haven't you, Stuart?
Yeah. I plugged... those ports were originally intended for printers that didn't have Wi-Fi.
Okay.
But I had a Wi-Fi printer, and I said, oh, what the hell, and just stuck a flash drive in it about 7 or 8 years ago, and, geez, I suddenly had myself some LAN storage.
Yeah. One of the neat things you can do with that, too, is that if you have multiple computers, map a same drive letter to that storage, and then, say, drive T or whatever, and then no matter what computer you're on, drive T is that LAN storage that you can access those files then from any computer on your network as T:// whatever. Really kind of cool.
Yeah. My router actually recognizes it as a either printer or storage, and its software has evolved over the years too, so you can actually make it network accessible. Like, what's the phrase? Not LAN, but WAN storage. WAN?
Yeah. Okay.
You can get at it from the outside. Let's put it that way.
I don't know that I'd want to do that.
You can with a NAS, and you can make your printer port the same way if you choose.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's a possibility.
If your router doesn't have this USB port, is there a way to connect to the Wi-Fi, like to put a hard drive to the router and connect it to the Wi-Fi? You need a USB port, do you?
Well, yeah, you'd need a USB port for that. Otherwise, you're looking at essentially setting up a separate computer that would then be always on and, you know, connecting over the Wi-Fi. But there's no way for you to just take, you know, a USB. Well, actually, I shouldn't say that. I think there are some external hard drives that have Wi-Fi capability built into them. So if you do get external storage, like a storage device that includes Wi-Fi capability, you could probably do it. I know some photographers who've actually set that up so that when they're out in the field, they can actually Wi-Fi connect to their camera, which you know, has Wi-Fi capability, and they can transfer files from their camera to this storage device over Wi-Fi. So they are out there. They're not cheap. I know that. But I don't have any personal experience with them. But if you Google for, you know, Wi-Fi hard drives or Wi-Fi storage or something like that, they will pop up. But they, yeah, they tend to be pretty expensive.
One thing you will have to be careful if you attach a hard drive to it is how much power it needs. The router may or may not be able to supply enough power.
Yeah, true. Yeah.
Usually a hard drive will need to be plugged into the
power brick or something.
An AC plug anyway.
Yeah. Or some kind of power brick, yeah.
Yeah.
The other way to do it inclusive is use a separate computer. And one of the things you can do there is use a Raspberry Pi because it doesn't need very much power power to drive the network attached storage system.
Yeah, you could probably do it for under $50. Yeah.
I noticed Micheline here saying she has a Moto E2 from Telus that costs $80. I'm not sure whether that's on a plan, as Chris was mentioning. Presumably it would be if it's from Telus.
Yeah, I was going to point out, if you sniff around, like, I have a Moto G Fast, which is only 6 or 7 months old since its release date. I got it for $1 a month over a 2-year amortization plan.
Yeah.
And after 3 months, I paid it off because, you know, I mean, it was a stress. But I don't have that extra expense on my credit card now. There are other phones that you can pick up for essentially $1 or $5 or $3 a month. From various carriers that they're trying to unload all the time. You just have to keep checking the websites and looking and then deciding if it's a phone that you are comfortable with.
Yeah, the carriers, they want you to switch over to them, and they figure there's inertia, so once you're there, you'll stay there, and they'll get your monthly fees, and if they have to give you a phone for it, that's actually a small cost to them.
Yeah, there is a slight catch. You sometimes get locked into a 2-year commitment.
Yeah.
Even though you're paid off, but you have an unseen commitment that is being paid off.
Yeah.
It's not quite up front, but you know, if you're going to stay with them for 2 years, what the heck?
Yeah, make sure you're happy with the data plans they have, though, for sure.
Yeah,
but
if you're just looking for a phone.
I had a question in chat that got overlooked, I guess. It said, we have two different URLs for the embedded web server. One is the IP address, the other one is the host name. And some of our devices are using one and the others are using the other. So is this something we should be concerned about?
I would say no. Yeah. It's every host name has an IP address associated with it, for sure. Like opcug.ca as a web server has an IP address as well. So every host name will have it, an IP address, and they're just giving you a host name. Because they are actually the upfront DNS server for you that can do the name resolution. And so they're just giving you the convenience of being able to use the host name rather than having to type in and remember an IP address. They're both the same thing. So I wouldn't really worry about it. Either will work.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Okay, I think we're actually 10 minutes over now. So Alan will lead us through the end of the deck.
Yeah, two slides to go. Next week is our regular monthly meeting. So if you need to know what all these funny squiggles are on the slide, then Chris is going to tell you everything you need to know about fonts and typefaces. And so if you don't know the difference between a font and a typeface, I'm sure Chris is going to tell you.
I will definitely tell you that.
That's the 12th of May, 7:30. So that will be a regular monthly meeting.
Followed
and
by
the OPL, the library, is starting up its Tech Cafe sessions in June. And on Monday, June the 7th at 4 p.m., Florence is going to be talking about password phrasing. So I should have told you about that tomorrow because it's password day tomorrow, isn't it? Little password day. So that's two things. And then our next meeting is, of course, next week. However, it will be following Chris's typography presentation. So, but if you have questions or topics you want to share, send them on to suggestion box, and we'll see what we can do. Thanks very much for everyone, and have a good night.
Thanks for attending, folks. We'll see you next week.
Thank you.
Spread the word about tomorrow's or next week's presentation. I'd like to see lots and lots of people there. I think it'll be a fun evening.
Yeah.